Welcome to this deep dive. Today, we're tackling hip fractures. It's a term lots of people have heard, I think, but maybe don't know all the details behind it.
Right, it sounds simple, but it's actually quite complex when you get into it.
Exactly. So our goal today is really just to break it down, make it easy to follow, whether you're, dealing with this yourself, caring for someone, or just curious.
And we're basing this on some really good curated information provided for you, mainly from orthoeducation.com. Great resource.
Yeah, really useful. But quick reminder, of course, this is just for education. It's not medical advice. Always talk to a doctor for any health concerns.
Absolutely.
Crucial point. Okay, so hip fractures. Let's start broad. What's the kind of the big picture here?
Well, fundamentally, it's a break in the upper part of your thigh bone, the femur, right near your hip joint.
And usually caused by a fall.
Yes, especially in older adults, that's the most common trigger. A fall often leads to it.
And the immediate result is pretty clear, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. It causes quite a bit of pain. And typically, you just can't walk on that leg. Standing is usually impossible right after it happens.
And treatment almost always means surgery.
Generally, yes. For most hip fractures, surgery is needed to line the bone up and get it to heal correctly.
But there's hope for recovery.
Definitely. The information suggests that with the right treatment and importantly, the right care afterwards, most people can recover well. They can often get back to their normal daily activities.
Okay, good. So, who should be most aware of this risk? Who's most likely to experience a hip fracture?
The biggest risk factor is age, really. Older people, particularly those who have weaker bones, osteoporosis, that makes them much more susceptible.
Is there a specific group even within that?
Yes, the sources point specifically to women over the age of 65. They seem to be at the highest risk.
And why is that? Just the osteoporosis link.
Osteoporosis is definitely a primary reason. Weaker, more brittle bones just break more easily from a fall. But other things contribute too, like taking certain medications can sometimes weaken bones, or simply having a history of falls increases your risk.
Right. And does this happen to younger folks at all? Or is it almost exclusively an older person's injury?
Much less common in younger people, much less. When you do see it in someone younger, it's almost always from a pretty significant trauma.
Like a car crash.
Exactly. A bad car accident, or maybe a fall from, a real height, something involving a lot of force, not usually just a simple slip.
Okay, that clarifies the risk profile. Now, you mentioned earlier it's more complex than just breaking your hip. The sources emphasize knowing the type of fracture matters a lot.
It really does. It's fundamental because where the bone breaks dictates the risks, the potential complications, and how surgeons will approach fixing it.
So what are the main types?
There are two main categories we need to understand: intertrochanteric fractures and femoral neck fractures.
Okay, intertrochanteric, let's start there. Where exactly is that break?
All right, so imagine the top of your thigh bone. Below the round ball part that fits into your hip socket, there are these two bony bumps, one bigger one on the outside, one smaller one more towards the inside. They're called the trochanters.
Okay, I can picture that. Muscle attachment points.
Exactly. That's where important muscles attach. An intertrochanteric fracture is a break in the area between those two trochanters.
So it's below the neck, the femur in that wider part.
Precisely. And critically, this area is outside the actual hip joint capsule. It's what we call an extracapsular fracture.
Outside the joint capsule. Why is that location detail so important for healing?
Because that region, being outside the capsule, has a really good blood supply. Lots of blood vessels feeding that bone.
And good blood supply means.
It means better healing, generally. Think of it like having good plumbing to bring in all the repair materials. So these fractures tend to heal more reliably compared to fractures inside the joint.
Fewer complications then.
Yes, there's a lower risk of some serious problems you worry about with other types, like a vascular necrosis that's bone death from lack of blood flow or non-union, where the bone just fails to mend together.
That makes sense. Good blood flow is key. What usually causes this specific type, the trochanteric one?
Again, in older folks, especially those with osteoporosis, it's often just a simple fall. Falling from standing height can be enough.
Wow.
Yeah. In younger individuals, you'd need that higher energy trauma. We talked about car crash, major fall.
And are these breaks usually straightforward, like a clean crack? Or can they be messy?
They can vary quite a bit. Sometimes it's relatively stable, meaning the pieces haven't shifted much, but other times it's unstable. The bone might break into several pieces, or the fragments are likely to move out of place. That stability factor is really important for the surgical plan.
And if someone didn't get surgery for this, what happens?
Well, that's generally not a good scenario. Untreated intertrochanteric fractures can lead to major problems: long-term disability, chronic pain, inability to walk. And sadly, especially in frail older adults, the complications from being immobile, like blood clots or pneumonia, mean untreated hip fractures significantly increase the risk of death.
Okay, so surgery is really crucial. How would a doctor typically spot this? What are the signs?
Clinically, you'd often see an older patient, maybe a woman with known osteoporosis who reports a recent fall. They'll have significant pain in the hip area, and they just can't bear weight on that leg. Can't stand, can't walk.
And what would they find during the physical exam?
Well, besides the obvious pain when trying to move the hip, there's usually swelling, maybe some bruising over the outer thigh near that bigger bony bump, the greater trochanter. And here's a classic sign, especially if the bone pieces are displaced. The injured leg often looks shorter than the uninjured one. Yeah, and it tends to be rotated outwards. The foot points away from the body more than usual. That shortening in external rotation is a big clue. Very rarely, you might get some nerve symptoms like numbness or tingling if a nerve gets pinched or stretched, but that's uncommon.
So, visual clues and the inability to bear weight, how is it definitively diagnosed?
X-rays. Plain X-rays are the workhorse here. They show the fracture location really clearly, reveal if it's in multiple pieces, and give the surgeon the critical information needed to plan the operation.
What if the X-ray isn't clear?
Good question. If maybe the X-ray looks normal, but the person really seems like they have a fracture based on their symptoms, or if the doctor suspects a very subtle break, like a hairline or stress fracture, they might order a CT scan or an MRI for a more detailed look.
Okay, so surgery is standard. Are there any cases where they don't operate?
Very few. Surgery helps people get moving much faster, which avoids those immobility complications. The rare exceptions are usually patients who perhaps couldn't walk before the fracture anyway, or people who are just too medically fragile, too sick to safely undergo anesthesia and surgery.
And what happens to them?
Unfortunately for those patients, treatment is often non-operative, meaning basically pain control and bed rest, maybe some gentle therapy if possible, but it's a tough situation with significant risks.
Right. So focusing on the surgery then, what's the main aim?
The goal is twofold. First, get the broken pieces back into their proper alignment. That's called reduction. And second, fix them securely in that position using metal implants. That's fixation or stabilization. This allows the bone to heal while the patient can start moving much sooner.
How do they manage that during the operation?
They use a special operating table, often called a fracture table, that helps hold the leg in the right position. And throughout the procedure, the surgeon uses a type of live X-ray machine called a fluoroscope.
Like real-time imaging.
Exactly. It lets them see the bones and the implants as they're working, ensuring everything is lined up perfectly before they finish.
Okay. And the implants used for these fractures, the intertrochanteric ones, the sources mentioned two main types.
That's right. The two most common surgical fixes are the dynamic hip screw, or DHS, and the trochanteric femoral nail, sometimes called an intramedullary nail.
Dynamic hip screw. Let's break that down. How does it work?
Okay, the DHS is often a good choice for the more stable fractures. What happens is a large screw, called a lag screw, is inserted across the fracture line, going into the femoral head, the ball part. Then a metal plate is fitted along the outer side of the femur, and that plate is attached to the bone with several smaller screws.
So, a screw and a plate. What makes it dynamic?
Ah, here's the clever bit. The large screw that goes into the femoral head isn't rigidly locked to the plate. It actually sits inside a barrel on the plate and can slide just a tiny amount along its own axis.
It slides.
Because as the patient starts to put weight on the leg during recovery, that controlled sliding allows the main bone fragments to press together or compress. This compression at the fracture site is really good for stimulating healing, makes it faster and stronger. That's why it's also called a sliding hip screw.
That is pretty ingenious, using the body's own weight to help heal. Okay, what about the other option? The trochanteric femoral nail.
Right, the nail. This is often used for both stable and especially unstable intertrochanteric fractures. Instead of a plate on the outside of the bone, this involves inserting a long metal rod, the nail, down the hollow center of the femur, starting from the top near the hip.
Inside the bone itself.
Yes, down the medullary canal. Then, screws are passed through holes in the nail and out into the surrounding bone to lock it in place. One or two screws will go up through the nail into the femoral head, similar to the DHS screw, to stabilize the fracture there.
Is there sliding with this one too?
It depends. For unstable fractures, the screws are usually locked rigidly to the nail to prevent any movement between the fragments. For some stable patterns, the screw going into the head might be designed to allow some controlled sliding or compression, similar to the DHS principle. But the main difference is it stabilizes the bone from the inside out.
Okay, that gives a really clear picture of intertrochanteric fractures. Outside the joint, good blood supply, treated typically with a sliding screw or an internal nail.
Exactly. That location and blood supply are the defining features influencing treatment and outcome.
Perfect. Now let's switch to the other main type you mentioned, femoral neck fractures. Where is this break located?
This one is different. A femoral neck fracture happens in that narrower piece of bone that connects the big round ball, the femoral head, to the main shaft of the femur. It's that constricted area right below the ball.
The neck of the femur.
Mm-hmm.
And location-wise relative to the joint capsule.
This is the crucial difference. Femoral neck fractures occur inside the hip joint capsule. They are intracapsular.
Inside. And you hinted earlier that this location carries a specific major risk.
Yes, and this is really important to understand. Because this fracture is inside the capsule, it's much more likely to damage or completely disrupt the small blood vessels that sneak up along the femoral neck to supply blood to the femoral head itself.
The blood supply to the ball.
Precisely. If that blood supply gets cut off, the bone tissue in the femoral head can die. That's the avascular necrosis, or AVN, we mentioned briefly before.
And that's bad because...
Because dead bone can collapse over time. If the femoral head collapses, the smooth joint surface is ruined, leading to severe pain, stiffness, and eventually significant arthritis in the hip. This risk of AVN is the number one concern with femoral neck fractures and heavily influences treatment decisions.
Wow, okay. That's a serious potential complication. What causes these femoral neck breaks? Same risk factors.
Pretty much the same pattern. Most common in older adults after a fall, especially those with osteoporosis. Again, women over 65 are particularly high risk because they have osteoporosis more often. And like the other type, in younger people, it usually takes high energy trauma.
And how do they present? Similar symptoms.
The initial symptoms, yes, hip pain, can't stand or walk, maybe swelling and bruising. Quite similar.
What about that leg shortening and rotation sign?
That's where it can differ slightly depending on the fracture specifics. If the femoral neck fracture is displaced, meaning the broken ends are significantly out of position, then yes, you'll typically see that same shortening and outward rotation of the leg.
But if it's not displaced?
If it's an undisplaced fracture, where the bone is cracked but the pieces are still pretty much lined up, the leg might look relatively normal. There might not be obvious shortening or rotation, which can sometimes make the diagnosis a bit trickier just based on appearance. The pain and inability to bear weight are still key, though.
Gotcha. So diagnosis, again, relies heavily on imaging.
Absolutely. X-rays are essential. And for femoral neck fractures, the X-ray is critical not just to see the break, but specifically to determine if it's undisplaced or displaced. That distinction is probably the single most important factor in deciding the type of surgery.
Undisplaced versus displaced. Why is that the key factor?
Because it drastically changes the risk of that blood supply problem, the AVN, and how likely the bone is to heal if you just try to fix it with screws. Displaced fractures have a much higher risk of AVN.
Okay. And if the X-ray is still ambiguous?
Same as before. If there's high suspicion but the X-ray isn't definitive, or to get a better look at displacement, a CT or MRI might be ordered.
So treatment for these... Also usually surgery.
Yes. Surgery is nearly always needed for femoral neck fractures.
Yeah.
The goals are the standard ones, reduce pain, get the person moving again, but also, crucially, to deal with or try to prevent the consequences of that potential blood supply disruption and AVN.
And the surgical options here are different because of that AVN risk.
Exactly. The options differ significantly from the intertrochanteric fractures. For an undisplaced femoral neck fracture, especially maybe in a younger, active person where preserving their own hip joint is a high priority, surgeons might opt for hip pinning.
Pinning, like just screws.
Essentially, yes. Inserting several screws across the fracture line to hold the pieces tightly together while they hopefully heal. The idea is to stabilize it without disrupting the blood supply any further.
But what about for the displaced fractures? Or maybe in older, less active people.
For displaced fractures, the risk of the bone not healing, non-union, or developing AVN even after pinning is quite high, particularly in older adults whose bone healing capacity might be lower. So in these cases, trying to save the original femoral head is often deemed too risky for a poor outcome.
So what do they do instead?
They often move straight to a hip replacement.
Replacing the joint entirely?
Either partially or totally. A partial hip replacement, or hemiarthroplasty, replaces just the broken ball part, the femoral head, with an artificial one. A total hip replacement replaces both the ball and the socket side of the joint.
And why replacement?
Because it immediately solves the problem of the broken bone, and critically, it removes the risk of future problems from AVN, since the damaged natural head is gone. It often provides faster pain relief and a more reliable return to function for many older patients with displaced fractures.
It really highlights how personalized the treatment has to be.
Absolutely. The best surgery isn't one size fits all. It depends heavily on your specific situation, your age, how active you are, the health of your bone, and exactly how that femoral neck is broken, especially whether it's displaced or not.
Okay, let's try and pull this all together then. Quick recap.
Sounds good. So we've established hip fractures are common, they're serious, usually from falls in older adults.
And understanding the two main types is really the key takeaway. Intertrochanteric versus femoral neck.
Right. Intertrochanteric is outside the joint capsule, good blood supply, lower AVN risk, typically fixed with screws and plates or an intramedullary nail.
Whereas femoral neck is inside the capsule, much higher risk of disrupting blood supply leading to potential bone death, a vascular necrosis.
Exactly. And that AVN risk dramatically influences treatment, pushing towards pinning for undisplaced fractures perhaps, but often towards hip replacement, especially for displaced fractures in older individuals.
But the bottom line for both types is that surgery is usually necessary.
Yes, surgery is the mainstay to allow for healing and mobilization.
And despite the seriousness, the overall outlook with proper treatment is positive.
Generally, yes. With the right surgery, good medical care, and really important good rehabilitation afterwards, most people can recover and regain a good level of function and get back to their lives.
That understanding of the types and treatments is so valuable for anyone facing this. Again, this deep dive drew from info on orthoeducation.com.
A great resource for patient-friendly explanations.
Which leads us to a final thought to leave you with. We've talked a lot about the surgery aligning the bone, putting in the hardware. But if the surgery fixes the break itself, what comes next? What are those crucial steps after the operation that are really needed to achieve that recovery and get back to daily activities? What does the hard work of rehabilitation truly involve once the surgeon's job is done?